As you may know, last week the Reserve Bank released its latest quarterly update on the economy. And so what I thought I would like to do this morning is to talk about three of the key themes that we discussed in that quarterly update. The first is the nature of the recovery in the global economy. The second is the outlook for the Australian economy, and in particular the expected increase in the terms of trade. And the third is recent developments in inflation. And here I want to talk a bit about the divergent trends that we're currently seeing in the prices for tradable and non-tradable goods and services. In the week since the statement was finalised, we've seen a lot of turbulence in financial markets due to concerns about the fiscal situation in Europe. When these concerns first arose, the concerns were about the public finances in Greece, and there were limited flow-on effects outside of Europe. And while the concerns continue to be focused largely on Europe, more recently there have been signs of a pickup in global risk aversion. This saw equity markets fall considerably late last week, and strains re-emerge in money markets around the world. And there are also considerable safe haven flows into the US dollar and the yen, and into government bonds in both the United States and Germany. Now, left unchecked, these events had the potential to lead to a widespread retreat from risk-taking around the world, and this would have damaged the recovery to the global economy. In the face of this escalation of instability, recent measures by the European Union and its member states, the IMF, the ECB, and other central banks, have provided investors with some confidence that the underlying issues are now being addressed and that support mechanisms are in place. This is important that it's done because restoring confidence is clearly a necessary step in what will be a very difficult road ahead for a number of these countries. More generally, though, these events again remind us of the very hard choices that countries can be forced to make if prudent policies are not implemented in the good times. In a number of countries, European governments are being forced to cut back expenditure at the same time that the private sector is cutting back. And the obvious result of this is a very weak economy. So in these countries, the capacity to use countercyclical fiscal policy to support aggregate demand has been very significantly diminished because of the lack of fiscal discipline in the more tranquil times. I think it's an important lesson. Now, while there's been considerable turbulence in financial markets, the recent data on real economic activity around the world suggests the global economy is continuing to recover from the sharp downturn we saw a year or so ago. And you can see this in this first chart, if I can bring it up here. I don't know, can somebody over there help me? Yep, thank you. As you can see, the IMF is now forecasting that the world economy will expand by around 4.5% in 4.25% in 2010. This is a much better outcome than was expected 12 months ago when the fund was forecasting growth of just 2%. At the time, the outcomes that we're currently seeing were viewed as a possible upside risk, although most observers thought the likelihood of this upside risk materialising was quite low. The main focus at the time, as it has been over the past week, was on the possible downside risks, which were seen to be both very real and very serious. Now, we now know that the various policy measures that were taken by governments around the world arrested the collapse of confidence that occurred after the failure of Lehman Brothers. In particular, they provided investors with confidence that policymakers would not stand idly on the sidelines while things collapsed around them. In doing so, they helped reduce the degree of extreme risk aversion that was evident at the time, and they also had the more traditional effects of directly supporting spending in the economy at a time when people were reluctant to spend. So while the global economy is clearly recovering, this recovery continues to be very uneven. In Asia, it's been a V-shaped recovery. as you can see from this chart here. But in the countries of the North Atlantic, particularly those in Europe, the recovery has been subdued. In the North Atlantic economies as a whole, output remains below the level it reached in 2008. And in many of the countries, it will be quite some time before that peak level of output is reached again. Now, China continues to be at the forefront of the recovery in the global economy. Growth in the first few months of 2010 has been strong, and the recent indicators suggest that this momentum has continued. As you can see in this next chart here, investment in the manufacturing sector and in infrastructure, particularly transportation infrastructure, has been very strong, and if anything, has surprised on the upside over recent months. The main issue here continues to be the potential for the Chinese economy to run too hot, which would put upward pressure on prices of goods and services and on housing prices. And recently, the Chinese authorities have been responding to this risk, announcing a series of measures to attempt to rein in the property market. The picture is broadly similar elsewhere in Asia, where there's been a very sharp recovery in industrial production and exports, as you can see here. Policy settings in the region remain very expansionary, particularly when viewed against the V-shaped recovery. Over the past couple of months, we've seen a number of countries, including India, Malaysia, and Singapore, take initial steps to withdraw some of this stimulus. And from our perspective, these are welcome developments, particularly given that one of the risks that's been getting attention recently is the possibility that stimulatory policies in Asia remain in place for too long, causing inflation pressures to build in the region. If this risk were to materialise, a more pronounced tightening of policy and perhaps a sharper slowdown in growth would be likely to occur. And now, in the economies of the North Atlantic, the challenges are very different. In many countries, financial systems have not yet returned to full health. Consumer confidence is very low. Housing markets have yet to show sustainable signs of recovery. And the governments face very significant medium-term fiscal challenges. Conditions in Europe, in particular, are weak. And as you can see here, domestic final demand in Europe is still not yet growing. In contrast, in the United States, domestic demand is now growing, and recent data have generally been better than was earlier expected. Both consumption and spending on plant and equipment investment have increased, business surveys have been more positive, and employment's now growing again. But just like in Europe, the recovery in the United States remains dependent on stimulatory fiscal and monetary policy, and the fiscal issues present a significant cloud over the medium-term outlook. Altogether, this international environment is clearly a mixed one. Australia's major export partners are growing strongly, and there are reasonable prospects that this will continue. This is a positive for Australia. There are, however, still downside risks. Despite the recent announcements having stabilised confidence in Europe, concerns about public finances there could build again. If they did, this would clearly weigh on prospects for the countries directly concerned, but it could also weigh on prospects in Asia, particularly if these concerns were associated with a marked increase in global risk aversion again. But while there are downside risks, one cannot rule out the possibility of further positive growth surprises in the global economy, particularly if confidence in Europe holds up and policy remains stimulatory in Asia. So as usual, the Reserve Bank will be watching very carefully over the weeks and the months ahead to assess how the balance of these risks is evolving. I'd now like to turn to the Australian economy, which continues to improve from the relatively mild downturn which we saw a year or so ago. As is the case for the world economy, the recovery in Australia has been stronger than expected. In a very real sense, our experience has been much closer to to that of many of our major trading partners in Asia than it has been to the other advanced economies of the world. As a result, we are operating closer to full capacity than the other developed countries, and the challenges that we face are quite different to the ones that they face. Now, in our statement last week, we published our updated forecast for the next few years. As you can see from this chart here, the central forecast is for the Australian economy to expand by 3.25% over 2010, before growth picks up to be in the 3 to 3.25 to 4% range over the next couple of years. Our forecast for this year is the same as that it was 3 months ago, but the forecasts for the following years have been revised up a little and now show above average growth. This largely reflects above average growth in both the labour force and the capital stock. And one of the really important factors that's underpinning this positive outlook is the lift in Australia's terms of trade, which you can see in this next chart here. We now expect the terms of trade to again to reach the peak that they got to in 2008, later this year. This would bring them back to the very high level they reached at the time in the early 1950s when wool prices spiked at the time of the Korean War. Now, over the past 6 months, the prices of most commodities have increased, although it's the prices of iron ore and coking coal that have risen particularly strongly. Now, these two commodities share the common feature that they are inputs into the production of steel. As you can see from this next chart, if we look back in time, global steel production grew strongly in the 1960s and the early 1970s when Japan was industrialising. But then from the mid-70s to around the year 2000, global steel production was broadly flat. This changed at the beginning of the previous decade, and growth in global steel production has again been very strong, and as you can see from this chart, it's run well ahead of growth in global industrial production. Now, this strength in global steel output largely reflects the very strong growth in manufacturing and infrastructure investment in China, both of which have been very steel intensive in their use. If the industrial experience of the United States and of Japan is any guide, then this strong growth in Chinese demand for steel could be expected to continue for some years yet. And over a slightly longer horizon, Indian demand for steel, which currently is very low, could also be expected to grow strongly. Now, of course, over time, a significant global response is likely to lead to less pressure on raw materials prices than we're currently seeing. But notwithstanding this, Australia looks to be very well placed to benefit from the strong global demand in the main inputs into the production of steel. And the outlook for the LNG sector also remains very positive. Now, this boost to the terms of trade this year will add significantly to our national incomes. In putting together our recent forecasts, we've assumed that more of this boost to income is saved than was the case in the earlier boom in the terms of trade. And this reflects two important factors. The first is the different position of the federal budget, and the second is the more cautious approach to spending currently being displayed by the household sector. If this lift in saving does not occur, then demand in the economy could well be stronger than we forecast, and this would put additional pressure on capacity in the economy. At the moment, though, the economy is still emerging from the earlier downturn, and there's still some spare capacity, and conditions clearly differ across sectors. Retail spending remains subdued following the large increases last year, and commercial construction remains weak outside the boost from public sector infrastructure spending. But in contrast, dwelling construction continues to pick up. The period of business sector deleveraging looks like it has come to an end, and investment in the resources sector is at very high levels. The bank will continue to monitor these differences in the economy very carefully. Overall, though, the central scenario for Australia remains a positive one. Our major trading partners are growing solidly, commodity prices are high, and domestic income is likely to go strongly over the year ahead. If this central scenario were to eventuate, a major challenge that we face will be to expand the supply side of the economy so that demand can grow solidly without adding to inflation. But at the same time, we need to be aware that circumstances can change very quickly. If they do, Australia is in the fortunate position, as are a number of countries in Asia, of having the policy flexibility to be able to respond to this change. Now, the third issue I want to talk about is recent trends in inflation. The March quarter CPI confirmed that inflation pressures in Australia have moderated significantly. As you can see from this chart, in mid-2008, underlying inflation was running at a little above 4.5%, a level that was clearly too high, with the economy pushing up against capacity constraints. Contrast, over the past 12 months, the various measures of underlying inflation all suggest that it's now running at around 3%. That's a marked reduction on rates of 2 years ago. This decline that we've seen reflects two broad developments. The first is the earlier slowdown in demand growth in the economy, and the second is the appreciation of the exchange rate. The downturn in late 2008, together with the elevated degree of uncertainty at the time, led to a considerable slowing in wage growth in the private sector. The weak demand growth also put downward pressure on firms' margins, and the appreciation of the exchange rate has recently led to price reductions for many imported goods. And given the inevitable lags, it's likely that these factors will see underlying inflation in year-ended terms come down a bit more in the near term. Notwithstanding this, the outcome for the March quarter was slightly higher than we and most market observers had been expecting. Now, one clearly needs to be cautious in interpreting individual pieces of data. However, the outcome in the March quarter is consistent with the idea that the disinflationary forces in the economy are not quite as strong as previously expected. And that's largely because the economy has performed stronger than previously expected. Now, one other aspect of the recent data on inflation that I think is worth noting is the divergent trends in the prices of tradables and non-tradable items. Over long periods of time, the prices of non-tradables, which are mostly services, have tended to rise more quickly than the price of tradables, which are mostly goods. For example, if you look over the last decade, the average annual increase in the price of non-tradables was 3.75%, while the average increase in the price of tradables was much lower at just 0.75%. And the primary reason for this difference is differences in the rate of productivity growth in the production of goods and services. If we look at the most recent inflation data, you can see the difference between tradables and non-tradables is currently quite large. One very concrete example of this can be seen in the divergent movements in the prices of health services, which are a non-tradable, which have increased 6% over the past year, and the price of clothing, which is a tradable, which have fallen by 3% over the past year. Now, the recent decline in the price of tradables reflects the appreciation of the exchange rate that I mentioned a moment ago, as well as tariff cuts at the beginning of 2010 and discounting by retailers in the face of subdued growth in retail sales over the past year. And again, looking ahead, these factors are likely to contribute to low rates of tradables inflation for some time yet. But for non-tradables, the picture is somewhat different, with year-ended rates of inflation actually picking up a little recently. This is partly explained by a number of specific factors that affected the price of individual services, but more generally, it would appear that demand for a range of services has been strong relative to the economy's current capacity to supply them. In turn, this pressure on capacity is putting upward pressure on prices. One obvious example here is housing, with the rate of population growth recently exceeding the rate of increase in the number of dwellings for the first time in many decades. One result of this is that rental vacancy rates are currently very low and rents are rising solidly, although below the pace of last year. Another example is utilities, where prices have been rising very strongly recently. Over the past year, the price of electricity is up 18%, the price of gas is up 9%, and the price of water is up 14%. These large increases follow an extended period in the 1990s when utilities prices increased by considerably less than the general rate of inflation, and the level of investment in infrastructure was relatively low. Recently, there's been very strong growth in demand for electricity, especially in peak periods, and this is requiring further expansion in infrastructure to expand supply capability to ensure the reliability of the networks in these peak periods. To fund this supply expansion, as well as in response to higher raw material prices, industry regulators have approved quite large increases recently. Looking ahead again, above average price increases are likely to continue in this area for some time, although below the rate of the current increase. Overall, the Reserve Bank's central forecast is that underlying inflation will trough at around 2.75% later this year, before gradually picking up over the next couple of years. The inflation, as measured by the CPI, is expected to be a bit higher than the underlying rate, reflecting the increase in the excise on tobacco, which is likely to add about 0.4% to the CPI. Looking back over the past couple of decades, low and stable inflation has clearly been one of the critical elements in Australia's good economic performance. And we need to make sure that this continues. Sustaining low rates of inflation requires inflation expectations to be well anchored and growth in demand not to outpace the expansion of supply. With aggregate demand likely to be supported by strong commodity prices over the next few years, there needs to be a strong emphasis on improving the supply side of the economy, and here well-targeted investment and improvements to productivity are obviously the keys. While on the topic of inflation, I'd like to touch on one final issue. You may be aware that the Australian Bureau of Statistics is currently undertaking one of its regular reviews into the CPI. In its submission to the review, the Reserve Bank has argued that there's a case for Australia to move to a monthly CPI. While the current CPI provides a comprehensive and reliable measure of consumer price inflation, more frequent data on prices would be helpful in assessing trends in inflation in Australia. This is particularly so around turning points and when unusual factors are affecting the aggregate CPI. The bank welcomes the open and transparent manner in which the ABS is conducting the current review, and it looks forward to its completion over the coming months. So to sum up, we continue to live in turbulent times. Over recent months, concerns about the quality of public sector balance sheets in some countries have overtaken concerns about the quality of private sector balance sheets. While recent announcements have alleviated these concerns somewhat, the path ahead is likely to be very difficult for many of the advanced economies. In Asia, the outlook's more promising, although challenges also lie ahead, particularly in judging the appropriate timing to move to less expansionary policy. For Australia, while the international environment continues to be a challenging one, the central scenario for the domestic economy remains quite positive. Importantly, Australia has the flexibility to respond to changing circumstances, and it is well placed to benefit from the strong growth in Asia. Thank you very much for your time and for listening, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thanks, Philip. Piers Bulger from BT. I'm just wondering, given the strength that you say, not only in the domestic economy, but certainly what we've seen also from the federal government this week in terms of where they see full employment heading. How do you see that play out in terms of interest rates, in terms of where you see the normal cash rate going over the next 12 to 18 months?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not going to answer it directly, as you would expect. I mean, these decisions are taken by the board, and I'm not going to speculate on what's going to happen. I think, though, that I can make a general point here, and that is that in Australia at the moment, the return on capital, the return to investment, is very high. Australia has, amongst the developed countries, one of the highest investment ratios to GDP. And it's certainly high historically. I think next year it's quite likely that the investment ratio to GDP is the highest it will have been in 50 years. And the reason that that's occurring is, as I said, the return on capital in this country is high. And we know from history that countries with high returns on capital and with fast population growth tend to have a high real exchange rate and tend to have high real interest rates. And we currently have both of those, at least relative to the rest of the world. Our exchange rate in real terms is quite high at the moment, and our real interest rates are high relative to other countries in the world. Whether they need to go higher over time will depend upon the balance between supply and demand growth in the economy. As I said before, I think our main challenge, at least under the central scenario that I've sketched, is to expand the supply side of the economy, because the strong growth in commodity prices is going to mean that there's going to be reasonably strong growth in demand. So where interest rates go is really going to be determined by how that balance between supply and demand works out over the next couple of years.
Hi, Dr. Lowe. My name's Pip Freeben from the Financial Review. I'd just like to ask a question on the resource super profits tax. Firstly, do you agree there could be some advantages to the Australian economy if some mining projects were delayed or cancelled? And a second part of that question, do you think this super profits tax could be used as a policy lever in the Australian economy?
Again, I'm not going to get into a debate about the merits of the tax. I think there's a general point here that really relates to the one that I was making before, is that the level of investment in Australia looks like it's going to be very high. As I said, the investment ratio to GDP, the highest probably in 50 years. And that's because the return on capital is high. So we face a challenge, I think, over the next few years, under this central scenario, of accommodating this very high level of investment in the country. It's obviously not in the individual resource companies, it's not to their advantage or to the advantage of the economy as a whole for all this investment to try and take place at one point. What we need is a gradual but sustained improvement in increase in investment, and I think the fundamentals continue to support that.
If it could be used as a policy lever?
I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not an expert in tax design or how these things should move in a cyclical fashion, so I'd rather not comment on that.
Andrew Robertson from the Late Line Business Program at the ABC. Your outlook for inflation seems higher than we saw in the budget on Tuesday night. I'm just wondering how you reconcile those two, those varying figures, please.
Well, I'm not going to speak for the government's budget forecast here, but I can just reiterate it, the comments that I made before. We see inflation coming down a bit further, as does the government, to around 2.75% sometime later this year. And it's still possible that it could come down a bit further than that. But the reason we don't have it coming down further is that we see, as we go forward, capacity pressures starting to build in the economy again. And they're particularly manifesting themselves in the non-traded parts of the economy, where, as I said, I think there is some evidence that demand is currently pushing up against the ability of the economy to supply various services, particularly in the housing utility sector. And then those pressures will continue for some time yet, and that underpins the slightly higher inflation outlook.
So you don't think that a CPI of 2.5% is realistic in the current environment?
Well, so our central forecast is 2.75%. It's possible that we could get a lower outcome than that. As I think Mark said at the beginning, forecasting is a difficult exercise, and we all know that. So our central forecast, at least at the moment, is for 2.75% this year.
Warren Bird from Colonial. You mentioned the exchange rate as a factor in holding inflation down. Over the time since we floated, there seems to have been a shifting linkage between the exchange rate and inflation. Do you see it as picking up and becoming a more important factor these days, or is it still being muted by, you know, importers absorbing it in margins and that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, over the last 20 years, I think the speed of pass-through of exchange rate movements into prices has tended to slow down. I think many businesses have understood that there are swings in the exchange rate and they don't move their prices very quickly in response to those swings. So that clearly has happened. But those effects are still there, and you can see them very clearly at the moment. And this is one reason why the fact that these things take time to pass through is one reason why we think there's going to be a bit more disinflation to come, because all the effect of the appreciation that we've had has not yet shown fully up in the CPI, and there's more of that to come. But your general observation that the speed of pass through has slowed is the right one.
I just might let everybody know, we just had the April employment numbers out a few minutes ago. So we had a 33,700 increase in employment, 33,700, about twice as strong as expectations. So I'm just wondering, is the employment market the thing that has surprised you the most, or what's surprised you the most in terms of how the economy's performed over the last year?
Yeah. Well, there have been, I mean, it's not just employment. Many things have been stronger than expected. I think in general, if you look back a year ago, people were very pessimistic. You know, global risk aversion was at extraordinarily high levels. And there were very serious commentators talking about the possibility of a rerun of the Great Depression. I think what happened was that policymakers, both on the financial, monetary and fiscal fronts, came in with credible responses that gave people the confidence that we were not going back to the 1930s. But at the time, a year ago, people were not sure that those policy responses would lead to a reduction in the risk aversion. But as I said in my remarks, we now know that they did, on the monetary, on the fiscal, and on repairing the financial systems. The responses were enough to convince people that the policymakers would not stand idly by. And once that risk aversion started to gradually dissipate, and particularly in Asia with the fiscal stimulus, the economy, both internationally and here, has bounced back. And employment in Australia is just one part of that. But many indicators have been stronger than people had been thinking a year ago when, as I said, risk aversion, remember, was extraordinarily high.
Philip.
Any final question? One up the back there.
Philip Lowe, Phil Lasker from the ABC. I'm very pleased to hear that you want the inflation numbers out monthly. That gives us more to do, so I welcome that. Just two issues. The obvious question, the budget making a greater contribution to savings, the timetable back to surplus was on the aggressive side of what most people expected. So therefore, will it, as the government maintains, ease the pressure on interest rates in some way? And the other thing is, what do you think of the class action against banks on exception fees? Is that a healthy development?
Two tricky questions. On the first one, I'm not going to make any specific comments on the budget. There's a general observation, though, that I think I can make, and that relates to something that I said in my remarks. When we put together our own forecasts of the economy, we've assumed that more of the boost to the national income that's coming from the terms of trade will be saved this time. We think the household saving rate's going to rise slightly, and that the government will save more of this boost to income than was the case previously. And I think what we've seen in the budget is entirely consistent with that, with the government allowing the stronger pickup in the economy to flow through to the bottom line, with essentially allowing the automatic stabilisers to work. So that's what we saw earlier this week is consistent with what we'd been assuming when we'd been putting these forecasts together. On the exception fees debate, I've got no comment other than the Reserve Bank publishes an annual report on bank fees. That will be out in our June bulletin, where we'll provide some updated data on bank fees, including exception fees, and we'll also discuss what's been going on in the ATM market. And that will provide some extra information for this debate, which I'm sure will continue for some time yet.
I think we had one more over here.
Philip, Kai Chow from the Sky News Business Channel. I spoke to one fund manager who said that he's concerned that China, you mentioned how the government there is trying to cool things down, but things could cool down with a thud and that there would be an impact on our resources sector. How confident are you that Australia can absorb a more abrupt slowdown in the Chinese economy and demand, especially if they're also facing this uncertainty around a possible 40% tax?
Yeah. Well, there are a few issues here. The first is the likelihood of a sharp slowing in the Chinese economy. I'm sure there are going to be ups and downs in China. There are in other countries and there will be in China. But I think they've got the underlying wherewithal to ensure the economy grows reasonably strongly over the coming years. I mean, they've shown in the past 18 months amazing dexterity in responding very quickly to support aggregate demand. So if the measures to cool the property market work more than have a greater effect than they currently expect, then I think they have the flexibility to respond to that. Over the medium term, as you've probably heard us say before, we're quite optimistic about developments in China. There's tremendous capability over time for the consumption to rise strongly. The consumption share is very low because the household income, the share of national income going to the household sector is low and the saving rate's high. And over time, I think that they're doing the type of structural reforms that will mean that consumption will grow strongly. So the medium term, I think, is very positive. As I said, there are going to be ups and downs along the road, but I think they have the policy flexibility to respond to those. For Australia, I think we also have the policy flexibility to respond. I mean, we've, over two or three decades now, the Australian economy has become much more flexible. It's difficult to predict how the world economy is going to evolve, but we have a flexible exchange rate, we have a credible and flexible monetary policy. We have a budget that's the envy of the developed countries of the world, and the government has flexibility there. So given that we live in this uncertain world, maintaining this flexibility is obviously key, and I think we're in a very good position to deal with the inevitable uncertainties the world has, but we've got to maintain this flexibility.
How resilient, though, is the resource sector in particular, though, do you think?
As I said, over the long term, I think there's going to be very strong growth in global output of steel, and steel needs iron ore, and it needs coking coal. Chinese demand for steel can grow very strongly for a number of years, perhaps decades yet, and Indian demand for steel has a lot of potential to grow very strongly. So the medium-term outlook is very positive. And I think that one issue is the extent to which current investment plans would be influenced by a temporary slowing in China. And my sense is because this underlying strong fundamental demand is there coming from Asia, at least in the medium term, there's considerable grounds for optimism that investment will stay very high here. That's not to say there won't be swings, but the medium-term story is a very positive one, and I think many of these resource projects are built on that medium-term story, not on what's going to happen in China in the next 12 months.